You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, Candy One, Candy One. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tonight's show is being underwritten by International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 124, and Painters, District Council 3. IBEW Local 124 has proudly served Kansas City's electrical construction since 1905. Our cause is the cause of human justice, human rights, and human security. Painters and allied trades representing painters, drywall finishers, glaziers, floor layers, and sign display and industrial workers. Quality craftsmen and women putting the finishing touches on Kansas City for over 100 years. We thank our underwriters for their support, the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, every week since May, thousands of Hondurans take to the streets in torch marches to protest the theft of millions of dollars of their health care funds by government officials, including the president. The U.S. media barely mentions it. Tonight, we'll talk to Karen Spring of the Honduras Solidarity Network about it. And we'll also talk about Honduras, Laboratory of Privatization. We'll report on the recent trip by the Cross-Border Network to investigate. In the news, new initiative threatens Kansas City minimum wage hike, and Missouri legislature wants to force immigrants who were brought by parents without documents out of college by charging them more than other students. Now for the news.
Today, Kansas City Jobs with Justice reacted to reports that restaurant, hotel, nursing home, and other owners are circulating a petition to repeal the minimum wage increase passed by the Kansas City Council 2 weeks ago. In a raucous demonstration this afternoon, a large crowd of angry protesters marched to the headquarters of the Missouri Restaurant Association in Westport to demand that they stop interfering with democracy to maintain wages of hunger at their establishments. Calling themselves Missourians for Fair Wages, the petitioners must collect about 3,400 signatures by August 25th. They've already turned in 100 signatures. If they turn in the rest before August 20th and the City Council refuses to repeal the minimum wage increase it passed July 16th, then it would go on the November ballot. If they turn signatures in before August 25th, then it would go on the ballot next April. In any event, it's very possible that this initiative would block the raise low-wage workers were supposed to get on August 24th to $8.50 an hour until the initiative is resolved. Caitlin Adams, Deputy Director of Missouri Jobs with Justice, said her organization was disappointed, to say the least, with the new petition drive. They are using this tactic to hold up an increase that Kansas City wants, she said, noting the council approved it on a 12-1 vote after weeks of discussion among various stakeholders. They are really taking money out of the lowest paid workers' pockets. Missouri Jobs with Justice is asking people to call Vic Allred at 816-753-5222 and let him know what they think.
And the staff of the Guardian U.S. voted unanimously Wednesday to unionize under the new News Media Guild. Union organizing of Newsroom is growing, especially at many digital news sites. Gawker voted to unionize in June. Salon announced plans to unionize as well earlier this month. The Guardian U.S. union has been voluntarily recognized by Guardian News and Media, LLC, following the result of that ballot. A statement released by the union after the vote said, "Our discussions with Guardian management have been conducted in a constructive manner, and we're confident we can achieve our stated goal, a long-term, sustainable future for the Guardian and its quality journalism." Mike Elk, who has been a guest on the Heartland Labor Forum, began campaigning to form a union at Politico after arriving at the publication last year. On Tuesday, he asked Bernie Sanders, "Do you think it would help the media if it was better unionized?" Sanders affirmed that he believed this was true, and that he believed the media had been derelict on its coverage of the TPP, which he described as the most important trade agreement in the history of our country. Bernard Lunzer, president of the News Guild CWA, said, "It's a big day not only for the writers and staff members at The Guardian U.S., but for the news industry as a whole. Digital media is growing," he continued, "and it's time for our digital reporters to receive the same benefits and protections as their print media colleagues."
Ahold USA, which includes 780 grocery stores across the country and online shopping service Peapod, just signed on to participate in a Fair Food program to distribute Coalition of Immokalee Workers CIW-certified tomatoes. Ahold, joining the Fair Food program, will expand the number of grocery stores carrying these tomatoes by 75%. Participating buyers pay a small Fair Food premium, which tomato growers pass on to workers as a line item bonus on their regular paychecks. Between January 2011 and May 2014, nearly $50 million in Fair Food premiums were paid into the program. In related news, after a year-long investigation of sexual assault in the fields from California to Florida, a PBS frontline producer declared the Fair Food program to be the single most effective prevention program in the U.S. agricultural industry.
Just a month before classes start, Missouri Dreamers at several colleges and universities are being blindsided by skyrocketing tuition and a loss of scholarships. Rather than encourage as many students as possible to excel in college, Missouri's legislature appears to want to end their studies by pricing them out of school. When it passed the higher education budget last May, the legislature inserted a provision in it contained instructive language to colleges and universities to charge students who have been granted Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Relief, or the DACA, out-of-state or international tuition rates, whichever is higher, and they revoked their institutional scholarships. While this language is non-binding, some universities have begun to notify students that their tuition rates are skyrocketing and their scholarships are being revoked as soon as this coming semester. At UMKC, this act more than doubles the in-state tuition rate to about $10,000 per semester. Both UMKC and UMSL have reacted by going to private sources to raise the money so that students who are currently enrolled can keep studying, but they only have enough for fall semester. So Missouri Immigrant and Refugee Advocates has launched a campaign to ask Governor Jay Nixon to end discrimination against Missouri's immigrant students and tell Missouri colleges and universities not to follow the legislature's non-binding recommendation. They are asking people to call Governor Nixon at 573-751-3222 and tell him that. There's also a petition at www.mira-mo.org. The news tonight was read by Ariana Eckel, Molly Madden, Shaikalyn Hams, and I'm Jen Zaman.
Yo soy blanca, obrera de la maquila soy. El sol duerme cuando adormitada yo me levanto. Voy al baño, hijita para arriba, se hace tarde. Marquito, su uniforme está planchado, se hace tarde. Me echo agua en la cara, hasta ahorita me despierto. Me apresuro, una semita, café con leche, se hace tarde. Tres cuadras caminando a la carrera y dejo a Marquito en la escuela. Vamos, Blanquita, camine rápido. A ella la dejo donde la abuela porque la recoge Marquito cuando vuelve de la escuela. Me apresuro, se hace tarde, pa' tomar el rapidito, pa' empezar la otra faena.
And that was a song by a very popular Honduran singer named Carla Lara, and it's the beginning of a song called Blanca about a maquila worker who is getting ready to go to work and is late and rushing and half asleep. And we're going to hear the rest of that song at break, where it breaks into a really catchy theme. So I'm Judy Ansel, and we're going to talk about Honduras tonight. In May of this year, the Cross-Border Network took a tour, organized a tour, to go investigate privatization in Honduras. We'll give you a little background about that in a minute, but first I want to introduce Melissa Styler, also from the Cross Border Network, who went on that tour. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, I am the coordinator for the Cross Border Network for Justice and Solidarity. I'm also an economics student at UMKC.
Okay. And I'm the president of the board of the Cross Border Network. So obviously we work very closely together. Melissa actually put together this tour. It's the second tour she organized. She did a tour in 2013. The first tour to investigate the repression of LGBTQ people in Honduras. And that was a national tour, as was this one. We drew on people from as far away as California and Canada to go on this. But we had a sizable group of folks from Kansas City as well who went on the tour. So in 2009, Honduras had a military coup. It was a military coup that was backed rather backhandedly by the United States government and the Obama administration. And that coup put in place a increasingly right-wing group of oligarchs, the richest people in Honduras, who have turned the country into what we would call a laboratory for neoliberal reforms, for the kinds of reforms which increase the difference between the rich and the poor, which steal land from people, give natural resources away to foreign interests and to the rich of Honduras, and repress labor law, labor unions, and also the campesinos, or the farming people of who are a majority in Honduras. So we decided that we would organize this tour to go see what was what. Give us a little bit of an overview of what we saw there.
Sure. Well, it's interesting because a lot of the same problem, the same economic problems that we're seeing really are similar to or mirror the kind of ruthless privatization that we're fighting in the United States as well. Cutting budgets for basic programs such as healthcare, the elimination of those programs altogether. In Honduras, and especially as you're seeing with these protests, there's definitely more corruption that goes into it. However, it's U.S.-backed economic policy that's creating these kinds of methods of privatization.
And also, Honduras just received a sizable loan from the International Monetary Fund. And the IMF, of course, is famous for what's imposing austerity on debtor countries. And sure enough, part of the requirements of that loan were that they privatize public assets, including their education system, their healthcare system, their utilities, and increasingly they're giving concessions to big foreign corporations to exploit their natural resources. We found out on our first trip to Honduras that they had privatized 70 rivers, clearing out people who live by those rivers and live from those rivers, and closing off access to them so that big foreign dam building companies, principally from China, can create hydroelectric power that they can then sell at a profit.
If they even sell it, a lot of the time that power doesn't go back to the community at all. It goes just to their factories, to be able to power their factories in indigenous lands.
So we started out the tour by looking at what was happening to indigenous people, because there's been some real strong resistance efforts on the part of indigenous people. And the first place we went to was on the north coast, which is along the Caribbean, to visit a minority who are Afro-Indigenous called the Garifuna. You want to talk about that?
Sure. So the Garifuna are predominantly organized through a group called OFRENE, the Fraternal Organization of Black Hondurans. And with that, they've been resisting the theft of their land, which, mind you, they're living on the northern coast, so this in the eyes of the capitalist, is prime beachfront property. And that's exactly what they're using it for. They're using it for tourism. They're using it to build five-star resorts on. Actually, we visited one of those resorts, and the PGA Tour was there on this land, on these golf courses, which the resort said was previously unoccupied, but that land was stolen from these indigenous communities.
Yeah, we got a tour. We said that we were potential investors, and so the lot of us, about 10 people from the U.S. and Canada, show up there and say we'd like a tour. We were interested in buying a condo, and of course they gave us the royal tour. It was very luxurious. It was beautiful. I loved the swimming pool. The beach was great. And, you know, we asked the guy who was giving us the tour, so you know, do you have expansion plans? And he said yes, and he showed us a diorama of the plans they've already drawn out to expand. And I said, and I pointed to the area that they were expanding to, and I says, does anybody live there? And he said, no, it's empty. Well, you know, 10 minutes after we left there, we were in the village of the people on whose land they were planning to expand. And this was a small beachfront village of Garifuna people who had been there since almost 100 years ago and had titles to their land.
This is a small community, too. And the police in Honduras, not only are they very corrupt, but they're not out to protect indigenous communities. They're there to protect capitalist interests. So they've been evicted by the Honduran police, about 600 Honduran police in this very small village multiple times. Very threatening to their children. They've taken everything out of their homes. And then they just have to move back in again. And it's been really traumatic for them. But the community is really vibrant and they continue to resist, which is really incredible.
And one of the things we did while we were there is we helped them design a emergency response plan so that if they get evicted again, we set up a phone tree where they would be able to alert organizations in Honduras as well as internationally to call the local police station and to call the local public officials in order to protest this. Actually, shortly after we left, they had a court victory where their deeds were recognized. And so we don't know what the next move is going to be. It's kind of like this fight over the minimum wage in Kansas City. You know, you think you have a victory, but then the other side cooks up some kind of plan to try to sidetrack it. So the next group of people, of indigenous people that we visited were the Lenca. Who are the Lenca, Melissa?
The Lenca community is the largest indigenous community in Honduras. We went to visit them in the Department of Santa Barbara, which was gorgeous, mountainous. Predominantly, these are farmers, and they work with cattle. And they've been fighting their land being stolen from them exactly for those purposes, but with corporate farms and corporate cattle herders. They have the rights to these lands. They have community land titles. And mind you, these indigenous communities, they don't have individual plots of land. They own this as a community. They all provide for each other. And so whenever their land is stolen from them, it really affects the entire community, and it takes away part of their personal identity.
And so we went to this land occupation, which was on a hillside, where the folks had been occupying this land for several months. That was stolen from them by a family of rich brothers from the same community who were not Lenca, who had really good political connections to local elected officials. And in fact, just a week before we got there, one of their members, one of their elders, was shot at point-blank range by one of these brothers who just came up and killed him.
And this is in front of the entire community. And just like I said earlier, though there were tons of witnesses, the police aren't trying to do anything to protect indigenous communities. The Lenca community is a nonviolent community. They don't fight back in the same type of, in the same kind of resistance with guns or whatever. They have an alert system, and they aim to protect themselves and to physically reclaim their land. And it's been really effective for them. They've had a lot of victories in the past.
Yes, in fact, the indigenous organization of the Lenca people, and of all indigenous people, is called COPIN. And Berta Cáceres, who is the head of COPIN, just won a very prestigious environmental award in the United States for their work in trying to not only preserve their lands, but also preserve the environment.
And then immediately after she wins this award, the Honduran government kind of rebuttals all of the work that she's done and kind of this the prestige that she got from this award by arresting her for slander, which is a much more serious offense in Honduras than it is in the United States.
That's right, yeah. So since we're on Santa Barbara, and they don't have states in Honduras, they have departments. And as Melissa said, Santa Barbara is really beautiful. It's also filled with natural resources. And we met with a large environmental organization of local people who are trying to prevent the environment from strip mining and all sorts of things which would be very destructive. But then we went to a place called El Nispero. El Nispero is a dam that's deteriorating, hasn't had any investment. This is typical of privatization, where, think post office, U.S., where the government fails to invest, fails to keep up a service, and lets it deteriorate to a point where then they have to say, oh, my God, we have to save this thing. We have to privatize it. And in this case, they have combined a foreign investor with local oligarchs who are unnamed, who will be purchasing parts of the national electric utility company called ENI, and they're parting it out through a process of dividing it up and giving it to different banks. And these banks have investors who are going to be taking it over. Well, the union called STENI, the National Union of Electrical Workers, is not very happy with this privatization plan. They've already suffered mass layoffs of several thousand workers as a result. And the local in El Nispero at that dam decided that it was going to take direct action. So what'd they do, Melissa?
Well, they've been occupying that site. Whenever this plan started cooking up, immediately the Honduran government comes in and cleans up everything very, very nice. They remove all of the debris that naturally occurs in the hydroelectric dam process, which they haven't done for years and years and years. I'm pretty sure that almost all of the employees that were working there said that they hadn't seen it for over 10 years, just so they can clean it up. So it looks like a good investment for these private investors, which, mind you, one of them is based in the U.S., pretty close to us.
So they've been blocking the dam since mm-hmm. January.
They have, and they haven't been letting in these private investors or people who are there to survey the property.
They also have this amazing PowerPoint show explaining why not only the privatization plan is not warranted, but it'll actually damage the dam. And the technology that they propose to put in there is actually going to undermine the functioning of the dam. So they're fighting hard, and they need support. And hopefully they will be able to hold out. So that was one example of kind of the pattern of how privatization goes, but not only the pattern, but the incredible resistance. We also saw incredible resistance among the people when we started looking at the privatization of higher education. We visited the Autonomous University of San Pedro Sula. In Latin America, public universities are always called the Autonomous University. They're supposed to be autonomous. And in fact, police and other representatives of authority are not allowed to come into these areas. Well, that's being violated, for one. But we met with a group of students. Tell us about them.
They were remarkable. I've actually stayed in contact with them since we've left. And
they're so active on Facebook.
I know. They're great. I know exactly what's going on with them all the time. They're really good about it. But actually, shortly before we had gotten there, the students had gone on strike. Hundreds of students had gotten into the university. They closed the doors. They didn't allow people into the university. And they had a sit-in strike. They were demanding that funds be appropriated to their university. Most of the school had been declared uninhabitable, that it was dangerous for students to even be there. It was really in bad shape. The teachers were on board. The students worked together with them. And afterwards, they targeted a couple of really active students. And mind you, there were hundreds of students who participated in this strike. But they targeted a couple really active students, and they kicked them out. And all of the students got together and fought, and then finally they let them back in. But still, the students are resisting even now because they haven't had their demands yet. They're also demanding that the head of the university system step down because they're corrupt.
We're going to hear more about these students in the second half of the show when we interview Karen Spring, who's the Honduras Solidarity Network organizer there, who's going to talk about the current struggles around the privatization of healthcare. But just to mention healthcare, we also went to a town in Santa Barbara and talked to a local city council person about what was going on with healthcare. And this was such a great example of how the government, the national government itself, is actually undermining the healthcare system in Honduras. Do you remember anything about what he said?
Yeah. So it was specifically for the entire department of Santa Barbara, but we were in the capital, and they had received money from, I believe it was the World Bank, to fund their healthcare system, and they called it decentralization, which is a step in the direction to privatization. That means that the federal government has nothing to do with it.
It's kind of like the block grants that they do in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And so, but the federal government still distributed those funds to them. But whenever, and they built up this really incredible system that worked super well. They had traveling clinics. They dramatically increased their ambulances. The entire department was able to be served. And it's a pretty big department, and it's predominantly rural. So that was a real victory for them. But the National Healthcare Department wasn't giving them any of their loan money, so they weren't able to fund these programs. And then they would blame them for not being able to fund these programs, so they would cut their loan money. And it just became a vicious cycle. The later they were with giving them their loan payments, the less money they would give them in return. And then eventually they demanded, after the coup and a few years after, they demanded that they shut down most of the quality programs in the system, but they still had to work on privatizing these things.
That's a pretty good summary. You know, the only thing that's left of the system they created now is a few ambulances they bought, which they're still able to fund to be able to bring people from remote areas in to get medical care.
But the clinics
are all shut down.
They have one 24-hour clinic that was there before healthcare reform happened that still remains. And all of the ambulances are not even funded by this loan that they got in the first place to supposedly improve their healthcare system. But it's funded by the town itself, and they're just picking and choosing and trying to find little places where they can find any money to continue to fund these ambulances because the entire department is in so desperate need for healthcare.
And, of course, the whopper of privatization is what's called the Model Cities or Charter Cities program that Honduras is embarking on with its first experiment in that. And that's where they privatize a whole chunk of territory and give it over to a foreign corporation, sovereignty and all, so that the Constitution, the labor laws are written by a foreign investor who has control of that territory, can decide who gets to live there, who doesn't. But this is a part of Honduras. And the first experiment in this is actually being done in the Gulf of Fonseca on the Pacific side of Honduras, where they're going to be building a megaport and then constructing a dry canal north to Puerto Cortez, which is the Atlantic port. And I assume this is a bid to compete with the Panama Canal and the projected Nicaragua Canal. So, but they also have plans to create model cities in tourist development and agricultural areas as well. Go on.
Mind you, this is a theory that came from a U.S.-based economist, Paul Romer. It was modeled after Singapore, I believe. And eventually, he just threw his hands up with the idea, saying that it was out of his hands and that it wasn't exactly what his vision was. But I don't exactly understand. It's complete privatization. There is no such thing as real democracy. It's whoever is the highest bidder, they're the people who make the rules. They're the people who hire the police. They're the people who say what you can do with the environment. They're the people who say what you can do with your workers. So I don't know exactly what he was thinking.
I see it as a form of neocolonialism, only you're not a colony of a country anymore. You're a colony of a corporation.
Exactly.
And so it's kind of the ultimate in corporate rule. To me, it's really scary. And the president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, actually had fired several members of the Supreme Court, completely obliterating the separation of powers in Honduras in order to get the Model Cities Program ruled to be constitutional because the Supreme Court didn't want to allow it to happen. Finally, I just want to say that when you engage in such a mass system of privatization in a country as corrupt as Honduras, you are going to get tremendous problems because not only will you have the breakdown of public services, but you will have massive theft as well, as we will see in the next part of the show when we talk to Karen Spring about what's happened to the Social Security healthcare system in Honduras. But first, we're going to hear the rest of the song, Blanca, about a maquila worker by Carla Lara. And I want to thank Melissa Styler for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Viene tarde, el reloj se está marcando y después solo son ayes que me duele, están quejando que ya vuelvo, voy al baño, no se excusen para nada o si no se me van antes que termine la jornada. Repetir 60,000 veces el mismo movimiento es cansado, doloroso, oye que te entume el cuerpo, tan torcida, mal sentada, mal comida y bien pagada. Hay mucha gente desempleada por si ya no quieres nada.
Es mi trabajo el que sostiene tu horrenda maquinaria que me ha explotado siempre al sistema. Derrotaremos al juntarnos las mujeres que peleamos y pensamos. Ya es tiempo, hoy es el día, es la hora de luchar, es tiempo de rebeldía. No más miedo, todas juntas. Pensaban que eras sola, se equivocan, somos muchas.
Soy ejército transnacional, manejo el mundo entero. Yo soy destrucción, tengo hambre de mucho dinero. Ustedes me pertenecen, tu vida es mi propiedad. Saben dulce las mujeres, son las que me gustan más. Mis doncitas esclavas, mi capital humano. Las tengo a toditas, comiendo de mi mano. Las devoro poco a poco, hasta que inútiles queden. Yo puedo comprar gobierno y también comprar las leyes.
Es mi trabajo el que sostiene tu horrenda maquinaria que me ha explotado siempre al sistema. Derrotaremos al juntarnos las mujeres que peleamos y pensamos. Ya es tiempo, hoy es el día, es la hora de luchar, es tiempo de rebeldía. No más miedo, todas juntas. Si pensaban que eras sola, se equivocan, somos muchas.
Está prohibido parar. ¡Muévanse, haraganas!
¡Haraganas! Si es nuestra fuerza de trabajo lo que te sostiene.
Te voy a sacar el jugo.
Y yo te voy a seguir demandando.
¿Demandarme?
Sí, y ganando.
A ver si puede. Yo soy ejército transnacional. Te controlo a vos y controlo tu país.
A mí no me controla nadie. Nosotras somos las CODEMU. Obreras, feministas. Somos muchas, monstruo.
Es mi trabajo el que sostiene tu horrenda maquinaria que me ha explotado siempre al sistema. Derrotaremos al juntarnos las mujeres que peleamos y pensamos. Ya es tiempo, hoy es el día, es la hora de luchar, es tiempo de rebeldía. No más miedo, todas juntas. Si pensaban que eras sola, se equivocan, somos muchas. Es el trabajo el que sostiene tu horrenda maquinaria que me ha explotado siempre al sistema. Derrotaremos al juntarnos las mujeres que peleamos y pensamos. Ya es tiempo, hoy es el día, es la hora de luchar, es tiempo de rebeldía. No más miedo, todas juntas. Si pensaban que eras sola, se equivocan, somos muchas.
Tops and Socks Back to School Fair is a free collaborative effort to provide school uniform shirts, socks, and school supplies to area students. The fair, which also will include a free lunch, will be held from 9 to 3 Saturday, August 1st at Southeast Fieldhouse, 6401 Swope Parkway. Online registration can be found at choose-hope.org. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Join myself, JZ, host of Mind the Gap, on the Thursday night special for the next Sunday Solace benefit for KKFI, August 2nd from 3 to 8 p.m. on the patio at Californo's Westport. I'll have DJ Pint Size, DJ Hank, Jason Kidd, OJ Shrink, and myself on the decks for music, sun, drinks, and fun. That is KKFI Sunday Solace, presented by Mind the Gap, August 2nd from 3 p.m. Don't sleep on it. Be there.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel, and I'm talking to Karen Spring, who is the Honduras-based coordinator for the Honduras Solidarity Network. HSN is a coalition of organizations in the U.S. and Canada. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Thank you very much, Judy.
We talked in the first part of the show about our tour investigating privatization in Honduras, and we were there in May. And while we were there, there was a revelation about incredible levels of corruption in the government of Honduras. But the protests really didn't start until after we left. So, Karen, tell us about what the scandal is.
So the scandal is related to the Social Security Institute, which is basically a series of hospitals that provide medical care and also pension funds for workers, Hondurans mostly, in the lower sort of middle class, that are work formally with companies or private companies or with the government. And so on May 8th, as you mentioned, it was revealed by a journalist working for radio called Radio Global, or Radio Global and Global TV. It was exposed by this journalist, David Romero, that a series of money that was taken from the Social Security Institute was laundered through ghost companies. And so in this money, and there was about, I think, between $300 and $350 million was robbed from the Social Security Institute. And the money was passed through ghost companies that were created specifically for that purpose. And then that money was taken from those ghost companies, and it was written to, and checks were written to a whole variety of Honduran actors, Honduran companies, and actors, I mean, you know, like institutions and individuals in the Honduran society and government. And one of the biggest things that David Romero exposed was he held checks up to the public and on his television show showing that the National Party of Honduras, which is the party in power now with President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who won the elections in November 2013, that this National Party of Honduras had received a series of checks that were written in their name from this money that was stolen from the Social Security Institute. And so there was sort of already a lot of suspicions that that had happened and that this Social Security money had been laundered and had been used to finance campaigns, political campaigns, or pocketed by the political and economic elite in Honduras. But these checks and actual physical paperwork and documentation exposing that just made it, you know, was basically the proof that Hondurans needed to sort of say, you know, we knew this is what had happened, and so that's when the Honduran people started taking to the streets and started denouncing the corruption, outraged at the fact that this institution that had been totally looted and that had, you know, had once been one of the best hospital systems in the country, was basically left totally ruined with no medications in the hospitals, a lot more people dying because of the lack of attention, a lack of diagnoses, a lack of treatment, and that money, instead of being in the hospital system, had gone to the political party in power.
Well, and from what we heard when we were there, people were showing up at the hospital needing care until there were no medicines for them, and they better go out and purchase the medicines at a pharmacy because otherwise they just couldn't get treatment. And also a lot of people, didn't they say that Juan Orlando Hernandez, the president, not only stole this money for his campaign, but he stole the election as well? I mean, this has been a charge that's been bantered around by a lot of actually fairly legitimate people. I think, does that add to the outrage that people have?
Absolutely. I think that the November 2013 elections that the National Party, you know, quote-unquote, won, you know, people were denouncing fraud, you know, from the time that they were, you know, even going to vote up until months after the elections. And the reason that people were so outraged at those election results is, one, because there's such, you know, huge and deep levels of corruption, both, you know, the sort of types of errors and corruption that occur sort of on a regular basis in every electoral process, but that there had been an actual effort to, you know, a really, really planned and coordinated effort to steal the election from the new left-leaning political party that had formed by the social movement after the military coup of 2009. And so a lot of people saw those elections as how they were going to take power away from the political and economic elite and the two political parties in Honduras that have maintained control, the Liberal Party and the National Party, for decades. And so people, when they realized that the scandal had not only, you know, basically left their social security institutes and the hospitals in complete shambles, they were really outraged that it was more proof for them of the deep amount of corruption and the fraud that had occurred in the elections. And so that is why people were so outraged, and that's why people went to the streets and began protesting.
And these protests have been going on now since the end of May, and it's now the end of July. So that's 2 months. And describe the protests, would you?
So the protests, they're actually being planned for various cities in Honduras, from the big cities like Tegucigalpa and San Pedro Sula, but also in sort of the medium-sized cities all around the country. And so when you go to the marches, for example, in Tegucigalpa, in the capital city, they're coordinated every Friday evening at 5 p.m. And so people, thousands and thousands of people, show up to the marches, and they bring along a torch. And the torch is lit, and they walk down the street. You know, they usually have some sort of route that they follow. They march from, like, a university to the United Nations building, or they march from, you know, the university again, or another key point in the city to the hunger strike. The hunger strikers that, you know, have been on hunger strike for quite some time. And so it's sort of, you're in the march and you can feel the anger. There's a lot of signs that talk about the number of people that have passed away from the fact that there's no medicines in the hospitals, and the number of people that, you know, passed away because of the lack of care. And, you know, I think it's quite a spectacular sight, because all the streets are lit up with these torches that everybody carries. And so it's just, as you're walking in the marches and you get these views of the thousands of people with their torches, it's just like a huge wave of flames in the streets. And it's quite an incredible sight, because they usually, you know, are called for the evening, and so it's already getting dark. But the whole, you know, the cities or the streets where the marches are occurring, it just lights up the entire street.
Who's calling these marches, and what kinds of people are out there demonstrating?
So the people that are calling the marches, they're called the Indignados movement. And the Indignados in English, I guess, would be like outraged or angry movement. It doesn't really translate very well into English. And so it's kind of unclear exactly what the structure is of who's actually calling these marches, and how, what is the structure of this type of movement. Because it's obviously a very coordinated action. There's people showing up with torches, you know, and there's thousands of people. So it's unclear exactly who is, you know, the representatives of this movement. I don't think that there's any sort of democratic structure built in, you know, within the leadership to actually know, you know, who is representing people, or who is representing the movement, or if there's just the key figures that have sort of risen and just sort of been the key initiators of these protests. And so in the protests, they have a very different dynamic than the protests that, you know, swept the country in 2009 after the military coup, where people, thousands of people, took to the streets to march against the military coup and demand the return of the overthrown president. And so these protests now, 6 years after the coup, have a very different dynamic. And I find that, you know, I marched in a lot of the different marches after the military coup, and when I go to the marches now, it's a very different class of people, there tends to be a lot more middle class in the marches. There's very different chants in the marches, different songs and slogans in the marches than there were after the coup. And so it has a very different demographic. And I think that, you know, characterizing it as something that more the middle class is involved in would be correct. But it's also, there are also people that, you know, were part of the protest after the military coup that have joined these marches as well. And they're in the streets as well. But it definitely is like, has a different feel to it, a different character than the marches after the 2009 coup.
I've heard about some campesino rural people actions blocking roads. Do you know about that?
Yeah, so yesterday, actually, there was a whole series of campesino movements all around the country that sort of had a planned effort to, and they blocked off various roads in all around the country. And they were demanding some of the same things. I think they did it as like a support to this Indignados movement and these torchlight marches that are being organized all around the country. But they, you know, they were demanding, so they want a, the same demands that this, these marches have is they want a commission, international commission against impunity, which is they want something, a neutral sort of international commission that's modeled after the International Commission in Guatemala that's monitoring a lot of the corruption in the government. And they want, they're demanding the resignation of the Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez. And they're demanding investigations about what happened with the Social Security Institute and the corruption related to that. And so it's really great that they were doing that, sort of, one, to put more pressure on the government to listen to the demands of the torchlight marches, but also because campesinos are some of the most affected from, you know, from policies, you know, land grabbing and efforts by the state to sort of, you know, take campesinos off their land in which they, you know, heavily rely on for basic living, feeding their families, and just, you know, just to live, basically. Yeah. So they had that effort. They planned that action all around the country.
Are the unions involved in these marches at all, or the protests?
So there have been some key, like, union figures that have been pretty vocal about the privatization of the Social Security Institute and the corruption. But I'm unclear as to what the actual position of the labor federations are in Honduras. I think that it's difficult because some of the labor federations, I think, are being threatened by the government, you know, because they were part of the governing bodies of the Social Security Institute. So they find themselves in a very difficult position such that they can easily be accused of being part of that corruption. And so it's difficult for them to, I think, join efforts that are so critical of the government when they can so easily be attacked by the government.
Yeah, I heard allegations that actually some union leaders were involved in the corruption. Do you know if that's true?
I think that there's a lot of potential for that to be true. I mean, that's the difficult thing in it here is that there's, like, no efforts by the government to actually investigate that. And there's no way for anyone to really truly know to what extent, you know, because there's no investigations being conducted, to what extent the government, to what extent the president, to what extent the national party or union leaders or unions or labor federations were involved in that. And so, you know, it's quite possible. I you know, that, and that's something that occurs in a country where there's just such high levels of impunity. You know, corruption becomes something that's, you know, that's sort of born out of impunity and, you know, neoliberalism. So right. It's quite possible.
Right. Of course, the unions, too, are fighting privatization at the same time, which, you know, it's really hard to understand how a country like Honduras can engage in privatization when it has such high levels of corruption, and why both the U.S. and the International Monetary Fund are pushing them to do this. But tell me, we met a number of students at the Autonomous University in San Pedro Sula who are very radical and who I've been monitoring their Facebook pages and see that they're very much involved in this protest. What are the students demanding?
So the students have been occupying the university, and they have been doing that for, I mean, they've been on and off occupying their universities, actually all around the country, at least in three or four different sort of regional centers of the university, the National Autonomous University. And so they're doing that kind of similar things that the campesino movements are doing. They're also demanding that they want an international commission against impunity. They want Juan Orlando Hernandez to resign. But a lot of their discontent actually started, you know, and their protests started before this whole Torchlight marches started. And so they're sort of taking this opportunity now that there's so many people on the streets and now that there's so much national discontent, that they're taking this opportunity to retake their spaces as students and their university, and they're demanding, you know, that the privatization of education ends and that the national or the university rector of, like, the head of the National Autonomous University, you know, actually engages in, you know, some sort of, like, fair dialogue with students, or that she is completely, you know, fired from her position given her really, you know, right-wing stance and her really repressive position against students. So, like, expelling them from classes, kicking them out of the university if they participate in protests. And so the students are just fighting back against the university rector and using this moment when everyone's in the street, when everyone's paying attention to what's going on, to sort of push their own demands that are more structural, I think, than the actual Torchlight marches. So they've been quite successful. I mean, they face a lot of repression. You know, the university rector sends the military and police onto university grounds to evict them, which is actually illegal under Honduran law. No police and military are allowed on university grounds. But the students just keep going back and occupying the university.
Wow. We only have a couple of minutes more, and I absolutely want to ask you what the U.S. is up to in all of this. You know, we know that Honduras is like a kingpin for U.S. policy in Central America. We've got a dozen bases there. And ever since the coup when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, they've supported basically the oligarchs who conducted the coup. So what are they up to these days? Do you have any idea?
So, I mean, the U.S., I think it was the U.S. ambassador in Honduras made a public statement saying that the United States with Honduras has never been better. And so he's making that statement in a context of absolute outrage of Hondurans against their government. And so I think that's a very telling statement about the U.S. role in Honduras and the United States' position on Honduras. And that statement alone kind of says, yes, there is protest on the streets every day. You know, yes, there's so much corruption, but you know what? We have great relationship with this government, which is ultimately, you know, the political and economic elite, like you already mentioned, the 10 or 12 families that run Honduras that, you know, control the economy of Honduras, control the Congress of Honduras. And so as, you know, the repression's going on against students, the United States is carrying out their, you know, business as usual with Honduras. They're sending Marines, there's active Marines on the north coast of Honduras in so-called, you know, trying to assist with tornado season and like natural disasters, which is just ridiculous to Honduran people and the Honduran social movement. And they're actively carrying out helicopter exercises with the Honduran military. And so, you know, this is standard. These are typical things that the United States has always sort of done, you know, in Honduras. But it's just insane to see it happening when there's so many protests going on around the country. And then as all these protests are happening about corruption and people are, like, you know, clearly exposing and very clear about how corrupt this government is, you know, the U.S. Congress and Senate are talking about this, you know, $1 billion plan under the Biden plan or the Alliance for Prosperity for the Northern Triangle countries, Honduras being one of the three countries that are part of that triangle. And so it seems sort of it's such a crazy contradiction and very telling of U.S. policy once again that despite the fact that this corruption is so blatantly obvious in the Honduran government, they plan to keep giving money to Honduras.
And, of course, every bullet and every rifle in the hands of the police and military is supplied by our tax dollars.
Yep.
Yeah, and they just keep it flowing. So we're out of time, Karen. We've been talking to Karen Spring in Honduras with the Honduras Solidarity Network. I want to thank you very much, Karen, for being on the Heartland Labor Forum.
Thank you very much, Judy, for inviting me.
And thanks so much for having me here today, Judy. If y'all would like to learn more about the kind of work that we do at the Cross Border Network for Justice and Solidarity, feel free to follow us on Twitter at Exporter Network, like us on Facebook, or visit us online at crossbordernetwork.org.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for July 30th, 2015. Support Menorah nurses in their contract battle, Rally, Friday, July 31st, 5 to 8 p.m., Menorah Hospital, 119th Street and west of Knoll near the parking lot C. Can't join the nurses in person? Call the hospital administration at 913-498-6000 and tell them you support the nurses and to settle the contract now. UAW Local 31 Jim Wells Memorial Golf Tournament, Saturday, August 1st, Sunflower Hills Golf Course, KCK. To register a team, call the union at 913-342-7330. Trains, Tramps, and Tradition, an evening of songs, stories, and poems about the wandering life, Monday, August 3rd, 6:30 p.m., Olathe Public Library, 201 East Park, Olathe, Kansas. Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee, Tuesday, August 4th, 6:30, All Souls UU Church. Try listening for a change. Ira Herod and Mary Hyde-Kay talk about Move the Money listening project at the Empower Missouri First Friday Forum. Friday, August 7th, 11:30 to 1 p.m. Westport Flea Market Bar and Grill, 817 Westport Road. Coalition of Black Trade Unionists Mass Incarceration Training, Saturday, August 8th, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. UAW Local 249, 8040 Northeast 69th Highway, Pleasant Valley, Missouri, 64068. Part of AFL-CIO's Common Sense Economics to understand the policies which injure the economy doesn't work for working people. And check out the Heartland Labor Forum at www.heartlandlaborforum.org.
And thank you, Molly Madden, for the calendar. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is called A Socialist for President, Not the First Time, and When Tenure Goes, What Happens to Academic Freedom? Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.